I know they're doing
Toyota Motors, right?
Toyota Motors. And so I looked and I did my calculations, and apparently I can risk-free lose 0.84% with no risk, no risk. That and also in their other section, they list four regions, but they don't have specific sales numbers on those four regions. They have it as a whole, like Central South America.
I'm pretty sure Toyota breaks down by region. Are you looking at the annual report, NK? What are you looking at?
20L.
Look at the annual report. They definitely break it down. The 20L is at the SEC file. So go back to the annual report. They have an English version of the report on their website.
Because I don't think I was able to find a 10K.
You don't need to. You won't find a 10K. It's not a U.S. company.
Okay.
You find an annual report, which is a Japanese company, and you see whatever filing they have to make for the ADR, which is not going to be a full file. So go back to the annual report. They should definitely have a breakdown.
And they'll break down what I like for Central South America.
Whatever the four regions they've broken down, okay. They have whatever they have to do.
And one last thing. They, for Europe, they have Western Europe and Russia. That's fine. And
in fact, that's how I break it down, right? I have Western Europe and Russia. That actually makes it easier.
But from what I saw on the spreadsheet, it was Western Europe and Eastern Europe.
But you can just Russia. In the Eastern European sector, there's Russia and Ireland. So if you have Russia directly, why do you worry about regions? They actually are better off than giving you regional numbers. Right? So you just use the region. So they combine the two? Or
they've combined Europe as Western Europe and Russia.
The question is, how much is Russia, right? So just make it all Russia. I don't know. Seriously, that's the thing.
And with Asia, they don't include China.
That you can pay with the spreadsheet.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, folks. I want to ask my standard question, because you kind of know what it is already. But I just want to remind you that your first quiz is a week from today. Again, I reminded you on Monday, but I'll remind you again. And I'll remind you again next Monday, and I'll send an email every day for the next 6 days. And there will still be people on Wednesday who will act surprised that there's a quiz. Nothing I can do about that. So it's a week from today. And the past quizzes, as I said, with the solutions are online. You have no idea where, I will send you the links directly to the quizzes and the solutions, so you can actually see that the quizzes will be as PDF files, the solutions will be Excel spreadsheets. So download them and start working. Don't wait till next Tuesday. There's too much stuff coming at you. So take it a bite at a time. It'll tell you what to do. Also, there'll be a review session next Tuesday at noon. Okay. There'll be a review session I will run. I'll send you the room details and specifics. It will be webcast, so it'll be recorded and webcast because I know you have other stuff happening on Tuesdays. You might not be able to make it. And I'll try to get the review session up online as quickly as I can. So by that afternoon, by Tuesday afternoon, you should be able to look at the review session. Okay, so any questions about the quiz? Okay. So let's keep going. Okay, we talked about betas in the last session. We talked about regression betas. So if you review a regression beta, it looks, in fact, as I was going through regression betas, I think I made clear how suspicious I was of that number. What are the problems with regression betas? What is it? You want to try? What's the first problem? What are the problems with regression betas? Ahan, you are not here, so now I'm going to start with you today. One of the worst things, I'll tell you, one of the worst things about this rule is you don't have place for a nameplate, because if this were a large class and you had a nameplate in front of you, I'd attach names to faces a lot sooner. I've considered different options. Last week, actually, I went into one of these party goods stores and I tried one of those little sticky hats, and maybe you could put your name on top, plaster it on your face. I can't think of anything that will not make you feel really cheap. So, but if I do figure something out, maybe digitally your name gets recorded, you know, goes up on the, I'll let you know. But as I get to know people's names, so what are some of the problems? You actually started with one, which is? It's backward looking. So that's the first problem. Second, lots of noise, right? Because we talked about the standard error. Any others? You can manipulate it. Because remember, I took Vale, I ran the ADR, then I ran to the gain local index. In fact, this week's challenge, this week's puzzle, if you get a chance, is I've estimated Volkswagen's betas, actually four Bloomberg pages, one against the auto index, which is just, you know, just the auto stocks and auto part stocks. The second against the DAX, the third against the Euro 500, and the fourth against the MSCI Global Index. Very different numbers, and depending on what your agenda is, you can pick and choose. So it's backward looking, it's noisy, and it can be manipulated. There's one other problem. How many of you are doing private businesses as your for your project? Anybody doing a family business or nobody had the guts to try this out? But you see where I'm going? If you're doing a private business, what's the problem you're going to have with regression betas?
We won't have enough data.
Do you have any? What do you need? You have no data, right? It's not even enough data. You have no data because there are no prices, no returns, nothing, right? In which case, you're completely and totally out to sea with a private company. So I don't like regression betas. I've never liked them. I was never comfortable using them even that way. Even when I was taught, that was the way to do them. So I'm going to give you a way out of this box, a different way of thinking about betas that I think will free you from the tyranny of statistics. Because that's what you have. It's a regression. It's almost like karmic. You have nothing you can do about it. Regression beta is 1.243. What? I'm going to give you the freedom to be able to override that beta. So here's what I'm going to do. And we actually started on this process last session when I started asking you, remember that software company, say, what can you do to bring your beta down? The reason I raised that question is I want you to think about what those levers are that companies can move that change their betas. So to start this discussion, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pull up a bunch of companies. This is from an old, so some of these companies might not even be around anymore. But what I'm going to do with each company is I'm going to take a regression beta I got for this company. And then I'm going to try to tell you a story about why this company has the beta that it does. And along the way, you're going to see the variables that drive beta start to show up. So let's start at the very top. Bulgari. What does Bulgari do? Make lots of expensive stuff that nobody really needs. I know it's passing judgment, but it's a supremely discretionary product, right? Can you live without a Bulgari? I think so. You think, oh no, I don't know. You're hanging out of the wrong circles. Extraordinary discretion. You're saying, what's that got to do with anything? It has a high beta. Do you see why? Because when it's extraordinary discretionary, in good times you sell a lot. In bad times people say, you know what, I can live without a Bulgari, but I need my groceries. So high beta because it has a very discretionary product. So file that away. That's the first thing you're going to look at is what kind of product or service do you provide. Let me go further a little down the list. Quest Communications. Telecom companies tend to have high betas. That's kind of strange, right? Because you think about telecom services, they tend to be pretty stable. We all use our phones. So what makes the betas for telecom companies high usually? Yeah. One is they have lots of fixed costs, right? You've got to put up those towers, whether one person is using them or 100 people are using them. What else? What do they add on top of that fixed cost? As if that were not bad enough, they add another fixed cost by? A lot of telecom companies, if you look at how they're funded, tend to borrow a lot of money. Don't ask me why they do it. They have fixed costs already, but they borrow a lot of money on top. I'll give you my hypothesis for why they do. Because it makes no sense from a corporate finance standpoint. If you have a lot of fixed costs to add to those fixed costs, if you ask them why do you do it, their answer is because AT&T did it 100 years ago. And that was actually true. In the early 1900s, AT&T and the original phone companies borrowed money to build the original phone systems. And why did they get away with it? What were they building into? A monopoly when they were done, right? So there they were able to borrow money because they knew that once they were done borrowing the money and building the infrastructure, they were the only phone company in town and they could pass on the cost to you. When Verizon uses that same rationale, what's wrong with the rationale? In borrowing money, they're building all this infrastructure, and after they've built the infrastructure, what kind of market are they going into? It's no longer a monopoly. You're going into this incredibly... If I were building a telecom company from scratch today, I would not borrow money. It's more like a technology company than the old-time phone company. So you say, why do they do it? Because inertia is the strongest force in corporate finance. You know what I mean by inertia? Why do companies do what they do? Because that's what they've always done. The reasons have long since disappeared. So Quest has a high beta because it has high fixed cost and high debt. We keep going down. Microsoft, beta 1.25. I first started tracking Microsoft in 1986, right after their IPO. When I first looked at Microsoft, it had a beta close to 3. Small, risky technology company. What changed? Well, it's not small anymore. It's not a single product company anymore. Its customer base has widened. And it's also accumulated cash along the way. So as you get larger as a company and your product base widens, your customer base widens, guess what happens? You start to look more like the market. Your beta starts to move towards 1. This is the force that Bloomberg is calling on when they do that adjusted beta, right? Over time, this is what's going to happen. You're going to be like Microsoft. Then I looked at GE, beta 1.15. What business is GE in? Really, the question I should ask is, what businesses is GE not in? Because GE is the prototypical conglomerate. You know what a conglomerate is, right? It's in multiple businesses. Let me ask you a question. What should happen to the beta of a company that goes into more and more different businesses? Oh, you're holding up your name. What's it, Roy? Okay, Roy, what should happen? This is good. I like what Roy is doing, right? Be careful. Should it go down or should it? It should move towards 1, depending on which direction you're coming from. So if you're a mining company with a low beta, as you diversify, your beta should move towards 1. If you're a company with a high beta, your beta should move to. So why? Because you're starting to look more like the market. GE's beta consistently has stayed above 1 for much of the time I've looked at it. Because the single largest part of GE is what? Of all their businesses, which one is their most valuable piece? It's not appliances. It's not aircraft. It is GE Capital. GE Capital by itself is one of the largest banks in the world. It's embedded right in the middle of GE. Okay? It has, you know, leasing. It doesn't do conventional banking, but it's a huge financial. You're saying, so what? We talked about debt, right? What do financial service companies usually carry in the balance sheets? Huge amounts of debt. GE Capital alone carries $150 billion in debt. Think about that. That's like a small-sized country, $150 billion. It acts like a ballast on the beta, pushing it up. So that's what keeps the betas above 1. Justin? What? They owe $150 billion. Well, you have to collect money as a financing company, right? They issue bonds, they raise deposits. They do what banks do, just like banks do. You don't think of it as debt in the conventional sense. Debt to a bank is like raw material, right? Deposits. When you walk into Bank of America or whatever bank, Citi, wherever you are, you put money in a deposit. What have you done? You've lent money to the bank. You don't think of it that way, but that's what a deposit is. But what does the bank do? It takes that money, it lends it to somebody else at the 2% higher interest rate and makes money off the spread. That's how GE Capital works. Is they borrow money at 4%, they lend it out at 6%, they make, it's an incredibly profitable business if you do it right. And it's the biggest single slice of GE. It keeps the betas above 1. Then I get to ExxonMobil. What's the biggest risk that ExxonMobil faces as a company? Its oil prices can go up or down, right? And oil prices move all the time. You're saying it should be a very risky company. How come the beta is so low? For much of the last 100 years, as oil prices have risen, ExxonMobil has done really well. But as oil prices have risen, the rest of the economy has actually been hurt. So if you're an airline, higher oil prices are bad for you. So the risk that you're exposed to could actually cut in the opposite direction as the rest of the market. You see, what about the last year? The last year is a very unusual year. Whereas oil prices go down, the economy seems to go down with it. So we'll come back and talk about what's different about oil companies today. But historically, commodity companies have had low betas because their biggest source of risk cuts in the other direction for the rest of the economy. In fact, can you visualize a scenario where a company could actually have a negative beta? It's kind of mind-boggling, but run with it. If you have a negative beta, put it into that equation. Expected return is risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium, right? So if you have a negative beta, what kind of expected return should you have on a stock with a negative beta? Less than the risk-free rate, right? You're saying, why would I settle for less than the risk-free rate? You know what a negative beta stock is? You're buying insurance. Against what? Against some big macro risk. Historically, the only sector which has had any chance of showing negative betas are gold mining stocks. Gold mining stocks obviously are affected by gold prices. Gold prices go up, they do well. Gold prices go down, they... What's gold historically been an insurance against? If you're invested in something, what is an insurance against? One, it's not so much during recessions. Gold actually doesn't help you that much during recessions. Maybe during crises, you could. But there's a bigger factor, inflation. Historically, if you look at gold prices, it's a hedge against inflation. It's an the reason is very simple. Gold is an alternate currency. Right? In much of Asia, for instance, people have always viewed when they don't trust paper currencies, guess what they do? They convert everything into gold. They hide it under the floor and say, no, I feel safer now. Whether it's true or not, gold has a story. So you're buying insurance, right? The key word is buying. When you buy something, I'm going to make you pay. How do I make you pay? I say, you've got to settle for less than the risk-free rate when you invest in a gold mining stock. You think that's absurd? Not really. If the bulk of your money is invested in financial assets and inflation can lay waste to it, this might be a way of saying, I'm going to protect myself against an inflation by investing. What if you put all your money in gold mining stocks or gold? What's your portfolio going to look like after 25 years? It's going to look awful, right? You'd have made 1 to 2. In fact, that's the history of gold. If you look at gold as an investment over very long periods, you've made about 2 to 3% as a return. And there are people who complain about this. They're called gold bugs. You know what they are? They think that you should put all your money in gold. And every day they send me an email saying, you should sell everything, buy gold now. 3 reasons. I keep the emails coming because I just want to see how many reasons they can come up with before they run out of reasons. And they've been around for as long as markets have been around. There are these people who think you should sell everything and buy gold. And then they complain. They whine and they whine and they whine about how unfair the market is. Because they say, look, for the last 30 years I've been investing in gold. I've been exposed to all that risk. And I'm getting this really low return. That's when I send them that YouTube video about living 6 lanes across a busy highway from a brokerage house and running across the 6 lanes to get to that brokerage house every day and saying, hey, I'm taking a lot of risk. How come I'm not being rewarded? Same reason. It's risk you chose to take. So that's the stretch of beta. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to take the variables I talked about and put some flesh on them. So maybe by the end of the next 30 minutes, you will have a way of thinking about betas that goes beyond a regression. So here's the first variable I'm going to look at to decide what kind of beta I'd expect you to have as a company. Betas measure how you move with the market. They're not a measure of overall risk. They're a measure of how you move with the market. So I would expect a cyclical company to have a higher beta than a non-cyclical company. You know the line between cyclical and non-cyclical companies? What's the differentiation factor that we use for deciding whether something is cyclical or not? What's a cyclical sector, a cyclical business? Well, but give me, what is it that makes a business cyclical? How do we separate cyclical? Actually, software is not a cyclical business. But be more specific about not certain times of the year. That's a calendar year, which is pure. Retailers, for instance, always make more in December. They're not cyclical. They're seasonal, right? Yeah, and we know that. So in a sense, we don't care, right? That's why stock prices for retailers don't jump in December and go back, because it's not a surprise when you say, I sold 30% of my, you know, items in December. That's the key. Cyclical companies do well when the economy does well and do badly when the economy does badly. Historically, I'll give you a classic example of a cyclical business. Housing. Housing historically has been cyclical. In good times, lots of houses get sold. In bad times, they don't. Steel. So 20 years ago, if you asked me to list out, I could have listed out these 15 sectors that were cyclical, these 50 sectors that were not, and cyclical companies would have had higher betas than non-cyclical because they tend to move more with the market. About 20 years ago, I discovered that this line was getting fuzzy. Fuzzy in what sense? If I asked you, is Google a cyclical business? You start thinking, what exactly does Google do? How is it cyclical? It's much more difficult. Now that we've left the smokestack economy behind and become the service economy, it becomes much more difficult to draw that line. So I'm going to give you the distinction I find most useful in thinking about why some companies have high betas and others have low betas. The more discretionary your product or service is, the higher your beta will be. Let me put some flesh on it. What do I mean by more discretionary? If your customers can live without your product, they can delay buying it, they can defer buying it, you will have a higher beta than if they cannot do that. Let's actually try a few things to make, because this is one of the most critical concepts in betas. It'll connect what we think about betas to other stuff you might be thinking about from other classes. Let's do a very simple exercise first. If you look at phone service, okay, across much of the developed world, phone service is not discretionary. In fact, if I asked you guys, can you live without food or live without your cell phone? It'll be a tough, tough choice. You know what? No, you know, maybe I can starve, but I still need my cell phone. Okay. So in much of the developed world, phone service is not discretionary. So if I look at the betas for phone companies in developed markets, I would expect them to be lower because people are unlikely to be spending more or less depending on what the economy does. But if you look at much of the emerging, if you look at Asia, Latin America, there are big chunks of the population that either don't have phones yet or have phones on which they're very limited service. In India, for instance, Reliance offers these phones for $1 a month. You can get the service, but very limited. Now, if India does really well, these people will be spending a lot more money. Phone service in emerging markets is much more discretionary than phone service in the U.S. So hold on to that thought. Don't get too caught up in phone service discretionary. But just assume that those facts are right. If you buy into the story that I've just told, and I ask you, what kind of betas would you expect to see for emerging market telecom companies versus developed market telecom companies? Your answer is going to be? Emerging market telecom companies should have higher betas because in emerging markets, phone service is more discretionary. I'll give you two other ways of kind of getting this concept, because I'm absolutely convinced that if you get this concept, you got betas. Put yourself at the kitchen table of the average family as they're making a list of what they're going to buy this month with their income. You ready? We're at the kitchen table. The family sitting across the table from you. They're making a list of what they're going to buy this month with their income, starting with most important working down. You ready? This bank page, what's on top of the list? You'll have food, utilities, rent, diapers. It's pretty nasty when you have, so basically you move down the list. And as you get further and further down the list, you start adding things you will buy if you have the money. A vacation in the Caribbean. And you keep going. My own island, the Caribbean, a Ferrari Testarossa. I mean, you'll never get down that far down the list, but it's so much fun making the list. So now take a look at that list. If your product or service is towards the top of that list, you should have a low beta. The further down towards the bottom of the list, you should have a higher beta. You ready? I'm going to throw some companies at you. And you tell me based on that list that you see in your head, whether you'd expect these companies to have low betas or high betas. Safeway. What does Safeway do? Grocery stores, low beta. Whole Foods. See, they're both, but you think, what's the difference? Well, you pay four times the price you'd pay for eggplant, but you get an organic eggplant. When you're feeling rich, you want the organic eggplant. When you're not, you say, who cares? I'm going to die anyway. So I'll buy it at Safeway. So within the same business, Whole Foods should have a higher beta than Safeway. Coca-Cola. Let's face it, you got to get really desperate to go down the generic cola aisle in the grocery store, right? And if you get it, you're hiding it from people. Say, that's not mine, you know. Brand name plus low price kind of come together. New York Times. Before you say hi, which I agree, what are the two ways the New York Times makes money? One is subscriptions, which is actually a very stable revenue base. Why? Because people don't want to send the wrong signal to their neighbors. What I mean by that is you've lost your job, you no longer read the Times, but you're afraid that if you cancel the subscription, people will notice. The guy's not getting the blue packet anymore. Did you see? He must have lost his job. So what do? You get the Times delivered day after day. You just put in the recycling directly, act like you're reading it. So subscription is pretty stable. But the other chunk of revenue comes from advertising. I tell people, you can tell how well the economy is doing If you lean over on Sunday and you pick up the Times and you can't pick it up, all you have to do is look how fat it is. In good times, it gets to be this big. Special section after special section. Who the hell reads a 150-page glossy magazine of clothes that nobody can wear? That means the economy is doing really well. So New York Times will have a high beta because its primary business is advertising. See how simple that got? So think about the company you picked. You picked a company, right? I'm not pointing at you specifically because you look like you have. Whatever company you've picked, think about what that company does. You've already got the foundations for thinking about, should it have a high beta or a low beta? Let me try a second way in which you can get this. Yeah. We'll talk about the beta for equity. For the moment, we're talking about the beta of the business. We're not quite ready to go to the beta of equity yet. So beta of the business is what we're talking about now. Now let's take a second try. Now, question. Don't make it more complicated than it has to be. Think of the list. As a family, when you sit down, you say, what sector is this product in? You don't, right? You think, I want groceries. You say, well, I'm not sure to get a balance here. I've spent. We tend as consumers to buy stuff. So just forget about sectors for the moment. Think about where it falls on that list. And maybe, you know, sectors will have a role, but may not, right? Groceries as a sector should have a low beta, but Whole Foods should have a high beta. So here's the second way you can get this concept nailed down. I think it's supposed to be a good weekend this weekend. The sun's supposed to come out. It's supposed to be 50 degrees, maybe 60. Walk over to 8th and Broadway. Take the N or the R, uptown. I'm going to give you very specific instructions. Don't get lost in Brooklyn and call me and say, what the heck am I supposed to do now? Right? So take the N or the R, uptown. Get off at 60th and 5th. It stops there, I promise you. And start walking downtown on 5th Avenue. You ready? We're going to go for a virtual walk on 5th Avenue. And everybody's done this stretch. And as we go down 5th Avenue, here's what I want you to do. I want you to stop in front of every business you pass and very loudly ask the question, if that business were traded, what kind of beta would I expect it to have? You're saying, why loudly? Because people will think you're crazy. And that's a good thing. Tourists will cross the street to avoid you. Saying some crazy New Yorker yelling something about betas. He might be Greek. I have to cross the street. Let's avoid it. Ready? We're going to go for a virtual walk down 5th Avenue starting at 60th. I'm starting at 60th, so don't jump blocks on me. Okay? What's the first business we pass? The right, of course, is Central Park still, right? It's the Apple Store. Let's keep going because nothing in that store is discretionary as far as I'm concerned. That's just my personal bias. But right next to Apple used to be another store. It used to be FAO Schwartz. No, you jumped a block. That's fifth. You've got to get. You can't cross 59 before I let you cross 59th, right? FAO Schwartz, high beta, low beta? Depends on who's making the list. My oldest son just turned 26. When he was 8, I remember bringing him into the city. Euphemistically, we used to call this coming in with dad to work. So we'd take the train in. We'd get off the train. At 34th Street, we're going to go to a baseball card store. So a baseball, then a snack. Some snacks got in every other stop. Then a toy store, another snack. And a baseball card store, another snack. Another toy store, another snack. And then after the fourth snack in the fourth store, he said, Dad, I want to go home. I said, but Ryan, don't you want to go to my office? He said, I don't care about your office, Dad. The truth would come out sooner or later. But this was around his 8th birthday. I bring him in. I take him into FAO Schwartz. He walks in, and there's an $8,000 Ferrari for sale. You're saying, that's a really cheap Ferrari. It's one of those miniaturized Ferraris. It's like the movie Big. It's a tiny Ferrari for an 8-year-old. I remember what my son said, Dad, if I don't get that, I will die. I said, I don't think so, Ryan. Let's walk around. If you're drooping on the verge of death, I'll bring you back in here and get you the Ferrari. 18 years later, he seems to be okay. Lot more discretionary than he made it out to be. High beta. So let's cross 59th. And now we're in what I call the Italian-French section of town. You have Gucci, Ferragamo, high beta, high beta, high beta, high beta. Keep walking fast. Don't even look at the Trump Tower and ask that question. God only knows what could happen to you. And then you get to Third Street and you see St. Pat's to the left, don't ask high beta, low beta. Lightning might strike you down. And then you get past Rockefeller Center, the betas start to fade a little bit. An amazing number of Duane Reeds start to pop up. It's almost like they're trying to get you because you zigzag your way to avoid them all. You get to 42nd Street, New York Public Library. Things are better than they used to be, but betas used to hit rock bottom after you hit the 42nd Street section. You had stores with brown paper in the windows. You didn't know what they were selling. Shady-looking character in the doorway saying, come on in, cheap, cheap. Cheap what? Just come on in. You'd see tourists going in and not coming out. I don't know what kind of risk that is. But if you made it through that gauntlet all the way down to 34th and 5th, there was a guy who sold umbrellas only when it rained. I don't know where he came from. I think he popped out of the ground umbrella. Crappy little umbrella. It would fall apart while you walk. But let's face it, if you have a laptop on your back and it's 6 blocks to the nearest subway and it's pouring, what could be more non-discretionary than an umbrella when it rains? If this guy ever could figure out a way to incorporate and trade umbrellas when it rains, he'd have a really low beta. You tell me what you do, I'm well on my way to estimating what kind of beta you'd have as a company. Let's move on to the second factor that drives your beta. So what kind of business are you in? Think discretion. In fact, in Econ 101, we gave this a different name, right? Discretionary, non-discretionary, we measured with what? Elasticity of demand. I told you every class you take in this school is in service of my class. Now you get it, right? That Econ class, the whole reason it exists is you can understand elasticity of demand so I can get betas and then do no corporate finance. Good. It served its purpose. Forget about that class now. Let's move on to the second stop. Tell me something about your cost structure. The greater the proportion of your costs that are fixed costs, the higher your beta will be as a company. Think of what? If you have lots of fixed costs, in good times you make lots of money. In bad times you lose lots of money. I don't want to insult anybody, but having a lot of fixed costs is like being manic depressive. You're never in a good mood. You are euphoric. You're never in a bad mood. The end of the world is coming. The larger your fixed costs, everything gets magnified. So if you're in a sector with a lot of fixed costs, I would expect you to have a higher beta. So let's think of a sector with a lot of fixed costs. Anybody want to give me a sector? Lots of fixed costs? Any kind of infrastructure business, so you're saying they have to invest first and then as they grow. So you could generalize to any kind of infrastructure. But let's make it something that we all use, right? Airlines. Let's take an airline. Classic example. What's the biggest single expense for an airline? Airplanes. And they lease the airplanes. Fixed cost or variable cost? You can't go to GE Capital, from whom you lease the planes, and say, you know what, our planes are half full. Can we pay half the lease? Doesn't work that way. Fixed cost. Next biggest cost is? Fuel. Fixed cost or variable cost? Once you got the schedule down, can you imagine? Pilot comes out and starts counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yells out of the window. Only 6 people on. Fill it up halfway. Let's see how far we get. I know there is this variable component depending on load, but once you've decided to take off from New York and land in L.A., 95% of fuel cost is fixed. So your aircraft cost is fixed, your fuel cost is fixed. And if you're a unionized airline, the employee cost is pretty... I've been on flights where I've been outnumbered by the stewardesses. There are 3 passengers, 6 stewardesses. The service doesn't improve any. But why are there 6? Because that's what the union rules require, fixed costs. Have you ever noticed that the airlines never have a normal year? They're either making billions or they're going bankrupt. That's what I meant about manic depressive. But to show you, even within this business, you can have breakouts. For 35 years in every business school in this country, there's one airline that's been used in case study after case study after case. I'm sure it's been used on you too in some other class, which is Southwest. I'm sick and tired. Because most people read Southwest completely wrong. So everybody says, oh, marketing guys, oh, Southwest, you know, strategy guys, of course, use their own usual bullshit about Southwest. So I'm going to use Southwest for my own reason. And I'm going to talk about what Southwest does that makes it different, at least on this dimension. First, Southwest leases its aircraft just like every other airline. Until about 5 years ago, if you took a Southwest flight, you know what the aircraft always was? What type of aircraft were you on? It was a Boeing 737. Every single aircraft that Southwest had was a 737. You're saying, why? Because each aircraft is unique enough that it needs its own maintenance crew. And they said right from the beginning, we want one maintenance crew at every airport. We don't need six or seven. So right from the beginning, they decided to go with one type of aircraft. Second, fuel cost. I take Southwest sometimes, and I hope they're not economizing on fuel. But they're one of two airlines that hedges fuel costs all the time. As opposed to what? Most airlines start hedging when? When oil prices hit $120 a barrel. When do they stop hedging? When oil prices get to $20 a barrel. In other words, they start hedging at exactly the wrong time. They stop hedging at exactly the wrong time. Southwest says, we're not oil price forecasters. You know what the other airline is? Singapore Air. Southwest and Singapore Air hedge all the time. That doesn't make your cost fixed or variable, but it makes it more predictable. Third, Southwest is a unionized airline. People are surprised when they hear that. But it's got the most flexible workforce of any airline I've been on. It's the only airline where a stewardess has checked me on. Has that ever happened to you on United? You could be sitting there until the podium falls apart, surrounded by stewardess. They're all checking the job description. I've been working here 31 years. I've never checked anybody on before. I'm not going to start with you. But here's the biggest savings. I remember the first time I took a Southwest flight about 15 years ago from the New York area. So I get this flight. It was cheap. I didn't even check. It said New York to L.A. So the day of the flight comes up, I look at the flight to see which airport I'm flying out of. And guess what? It wasn't Newark. It wasn't JFK. It wasn't LaGuardia. You know where it flew out of? A place called Islip. I don't mean to insult anybody who grew up in Islip. I had no idea where Islip was. I'd look it up on the map. It's some small town in Long Island. Can you imagine getting into a cab and say, take me to Islip? So I go to Islip. There's this little tiny airport. Only Southwest flies out of there. I leave. I expect to land in LAX. I come out and there's a big statue of John Wayne in front of me. I said, this isn't LAX. I'd landed in Santa Ana Airport, which is the airport that serves. No. This was something that Southwest did systematically. They flew out of one no-name airport into another no-name airport. I said, why would they do that? Have you ever flown United out of Newark? Every person during their life should experience this once, and only once. Unfortunately, I experienced it multiple times every year. Terminal C, for 200 gates. I think United does this for laughs. They fly into gate 3, give you a connecting flight in gate 135. There's some guy upstairs watching you run on camera, say, they'll never make it, let's switch the signs on him. Like rats in a maze, they're all running, right? You know what? How does United get the rights to all those gates? What does it have to do? Well, you can get it from the government. You can bribe a lot of people. But ultimately, to keep those gates, you have to pay Newark Airport. That's how Heathrow is British Airways. For the longest time, they would not let Virgin Atlantic fly into Heathrow because British Airways owned those gates. It's a mixed blessing. You own the gates, you've got to pay for them. You've got to pay for them whether one flight leaves out of the gate or 100 flights. It's a fixed cost. Right from the beginning, Southwest said, we're not paying those fixed costs. And in fact, Europe, a lot of the discount airlines imitate Southwest. I still remember flying on a discount airline into Paris. I get off, and I don't see Paris anywhere nearby. I go to the counter and say, where's Paris? It's 120 miles that way. I said, what? It said Paris on my ticket. He said, this is technically Paris. I said, technically, where does the circle stop before it stops being Paris? Can I get to Belgium and it's still Paris? So how do I get to Paris? I said, start walking. I learned my lesson, but in a sense, they're following the Southwest rule book, which is keep fixed costs low. And how does this help Southwest? It makes their earnings much less volatile. Post 9/11, when the other airlines were all almost completely bankrupt, Southwest's market cap was greater than the market cap of all of the other U.S. airlines put together in early 2002. So the benefit Southwest gets is much more stable earnings. Have they given up something for this? I mean, there are lots of people who would not fly out of Islip. A lot of business people said, So they gave up revenues. What I'm trying to say is there's a trade-off here. They did not. This was not an unmixed blessing for Southwest. They chose to give up revenues to get more flexible costs. So the second stop I'm going to make is, what kind of cost structure do you have as a company? And here I'm going to run into a practical problem. Those of you who pick companies, you look at your income statements. Go back and take another look to see if, in fact, accountants in your company broke down expenses into fixed costs and variable costs. I've never seen a company where they give you that. They might give you SG&A, and you could guess whether it's fixed or variable, but it's all guessing. So I'm going to give you a shortcut that I find useful in thinking about whether a company has high operating leverage or not. Think of what operating leverage is. When you have lots of fixed costs, small changes in revenues translate into big changes in operating income, right? That's the essence of fixed operating. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a long period of your history. I'm going to look at your percentage change in revenues each year. And I'm going to look at the percentage change in operating income. Don't do it for 1 year. Strange things can happen in a year. But let's say I can do this for 25 years. And then I'm going to divide the percentage change in operating income by the percentage change in revenues. Do you see what I'm trying to figure out? For any given change in revenues, how big a change do you get in operating income? The bigger the change, the higher the operating leverage. Rather than talk in abstractions, let me show you what the numbers look like for Disney. I went back all the way to 87. I got the sales every year. So that's just the revenue every year. I computed the percentage change in revenues every year. So far, nothing, no rocket science here. I got the operating income for the company every year, and I computed the percentage change in operating income every year. On average, across the entire time period, my revenues increased about 11.79% a year. My operating income increased 11.91% a year. I divided the 11.91 by the 11.79. I came up with 1.01. You say, what do I do with it? Hang on just a moment. Before I even go further, I have to tell you that Disney changed considerably as a company in 96, because that's the year they bought Cap Cities ABC. So I said, maybe I should look at post-96. Post-96, that number is 1.25. I know I'm going to go on a dangerous road now, but follow me anyway. If I just look at those two numbers, the first conclusion I can draw is Disney's fixed cost increased after they bought Cap Cities ABC. Do you see what I'm basing that on? The 1.01 became 1.25. But now I want to ask, is that a high number, the 1.25? To make that judgment, here's what I did. I computed this ratio for all of the other entertainment companies. Change in operating income divided by, and that number was 1.35 across all entertainment companies. So let's say you took the 1.01 or the 1.25 for Disney. Let's say you trust me on those numbers. And the entertainment sector's average is 1.35. Holding all else constant, would you expect Disney to have a lower beta than the typical entertainment company or a higher beta? You got a 50-50 shot, so give it a shot. You're going to have a lower beta. Why? Because their fixed costs are lower than the typical company. The reason I'm not going to, I wouldn't get too carried away is 1.25 versus 1.35 is really close. If you do this for the airline business, the difference between Southwest and the rest of the business is huge. You don't even have to sit there and say, is there a difference? It's huge. Those are the cases we have to bring in fixed costs and think about how will it affect my beta. So that's the second stop. So at this stage, where are we? If you're selling a discretionary product, you'll have a high beta. If you have lots of fixed costs, you're going to have a high beta. Let's bring in the third factor. See those all those little question marks? That's Microsoft playing games with my slides. Hopefully the slides you have shouldn't be question marks. For whatever reason, when I go from Mac to PC, Bill Gates decides to screw my slides over. All my betas start to become question marks. Okay. So wherever you see a question mark, just replace it with a beta. To understand what I'm going to bring in next, think about what I said about fixed costs. Why do fixed costs make your business more risky? Because changes in revenues translate into bigger changes in earnings, right? Why does debt make your equity more risky? What does debt create that you did not have before you borrowed? Interest expenses. Those interest expenses have to be paid in good times. They've also got to be paid in bad times. So if you think about equity earnings in a company, You can take a safe business and by borrowing money make the equity riskier. This is the question that was raised earlier about the beta for equity versus the beta for the business. You can have a safe business with a risky equity if I borrow enough money. And to understand the divergence, I'm going to talk about two different betas. Question. Equity holders always last in line. So it's not always, so that's always the case. So as you borrow money, I'm just getting further behind in line. So it's not even a question. Subordination is a word used only within the context of debt. Equity, by definition, is a residual cash flow. You get whatever's left over. And what I've done is made whatever's left over into a much more risky number because I've chosen to borrow money. So here's what I'm going to do to introduce the effect of debt on the beta of your stock. So now we're talking about the beta of equity in a company as opposed to the beta of the business. I'm going to introduce two betas. The first beta I'm going to call an unlevered beta. It's going to hang in there. It's going to get a little confusing. An unlevered beta is the beta of the business you're in. Given your fixed costs, the discretionary, all of that is in your... So the first two factors in the unlevered beta. Then I'm going to look at how much you borrow by using what's called a debt-to-equity ratio. The best way to think about the debt-to-equity ratio is for every dollar of equity, how much do you borrow? So when your debt-to-equity ratio is 0.5, for every dollar of equity, you borrow $0.5. Because betas are a market number, the numbers I should use for debt and equity should also be market values, not book values. We'll come back and talk about the distinction. So I'm going to look at how much you borrow with the debt-to-equity ratio. Here's the easiest scenario. You never borrow money, in which case your debt-to-equity is going to be zero. Your unlevered beta, so your equity, that's the one scenario where your equity beta is going to be equal to your business beta. If you do borrow money, I'm going to measure the debt-to-equity ratio. Now, as you borrow more money, the debt-to-equity ratio is going to get higher. Everybody with me so far? I'm going to take my unlevered beta, and I'm going to scale it up to reflect how much you borrow. So as you borrow more, your equity beta will go up. You see, what's that 1 minus T doing in there? What is it doing in there? Yeah. Because interest expenses are tax deductible. It's a fixed cost, but the government puts its hand over your shoulder saying, don't worry, we'll bear some of the cost for you. That's what the tax benefit does. So the 1 minus T reduces the impact of debt and makes your equity less exposed to risk. If you took out the interest tax deduction, equity would be a lot more affected by debt than it is right now. So what I'm doing here is going from an unlevered business beta to an equity beta. Now let's connect this back to what we did last session. Remember that regression beta I came up with for Disney? And you, if you printed off the regression beta for your company, you have a raw beta for your company. Is a regression beta a levered beta or an unlevered beta? Yes, sir. It's a levered beta, you're right. But how the heck did leverage creep in there? Because all I did was take a regression of returns on the stock against return. I never considered debt to equity anywhere in that process. So how did leverage come in there, Justin? It's built into the stock price. You're right, but be more explicit. What is it, what do you mean when you say built into the stock price?
The company has a good balance of debt and equity. If it has a bad balance,
it's not a good or bad. As it borrows money, what happens to the equity price? Whether it's good or bad, as you borrow money, your equity returns will get more volatile, right? Why? Because everything's going to swing around. It's that manic depressive thing. It's got nothing to do with good or bad. As you borrow money, whether it's good or bad, right or wrong amount of debt, your equity will always get riskier. So when you run the regression, the returns on your stock capture how much you borrowed, but over the period of your regression. Do you see why I'm drawing that distinction? If Disney borrowed $1 billion in the very last month of your regression, it's not going to show up in your regression beta, because your regression beta is over a 5-year period. So the debt-to-equity ratio that's embedded in your regression beta is the debt-to-equity ratio your company had during the period of the regression. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back and get that regression beta I had for Disney, 1.25. I know it's a levered beta, and I'm going to do something very strange, and you're going to see in a minute how this is going to help me. I want to take out from that regression beta the effect of debt. I want to clean it up, go back to an unlevered beta. Say, why do you want to do that? You already have an equity beta. Why are you making life so difficult? You'll see why I need this. So what do I need? I need to take out the effect of debt, but the debt-to-equity ratio that's embedded in the beta is the average debt-to-equity ratio that Disney had during the period of the regression. That number was 19.44%. So I have the regression beta, 1.25. The marginal tax rate for Disney, and I'll come back and talk about how I come up with the 36.1%, is 36.1%. And the debt to equity ratio I'm using is the debt to equity during the period of the regression. This is called unlevering a beta. What I'm doing is taking out from my regression beta the effect of debt. And what I end up with as my unlevered beta for Disney is 1.11. Have you ever watched Jeopardy? Remember, you've seen the show? It's a very strange show. It took me about 5 years to actually get used to it. What makes that show kind of backwards is you're given the answer and you have to guess the question. Ready? I'm going to give you an answer and I'd like you to guess the question. If 1.1119 is the answer, what is the damn question? And don't say, what's your unlevered beta? I'd like something a little deeper than that. So what is the question to which 1.1119 is the answer? Yes? Just. What is the beta for Disney's business, right? Not betas. So the first question to which it's the answer is, what's the beta of Disney's business? What business is Disney? Is it the theme park business, the movie business, the broadcasting? What's the beta of the business? Very different from what the beta of your stock is. There's a second question to which it's also the answer. Anybody want to try? What's the second question? Yeah. Because when you borrow money, you just made your equity riskier. So think like you're investing in a business. You're an equity investor. If I have no debt, you see some risk in the business. If I now borrow money and you invest in my same business, I've just made your equity riskier because you now have to make interest payments. Okay? Here's the second question to which this is the answer. Did Disney have to borrow money? Is there some law that says companies have to borrow money? Could Disney have been an all-equity funded company if it had chosen to? Sure, right? So here's the second question. If Disney had been an all-equity funded company over the last 5 years, what would its beta have been? The answer is 1.1119. Now let me explain why this is a useful number to know. Do companies change their debt-to-equity ratios all the time? In fact, they don't even have to change it, right? What did I say? It was a market debt-to-market equity. So if I compute LinkedIn's debt-to-equity ratio on January 1st and today, the number is going to be very different. Why? Because the equity is now down 45%. So debt-to-equity ratios change all the time. And when debt-to-equity ratios change, your beta should change, right? I've given you a way of now telling me what the beta will be for Disney at any debt-to-equity ratio. How? This is the unlevered beta. If I now give you a debt-to-equity ratio, 10, 20, 50, 80, 100, 200, 500, 900%, you should have no trouble telling me what the beta for Disney's equity will be at that debt-to-equity ratio by just plugging the numbers in. The unlevered beta, of course, is always 1.1119, but all that's changing is you're using more debt to finance the business. So if Disney uses 10% debt and 90% equity, so the first column is the proportion of your overall market capital that comes from debt. So if I go to a 10% debt-to-capital ratio, I have 10 debt, 90 equity, 10 divided by 90 is my debt-to-equity. I go to 20 debt, 80 equity, 20 divided by 80 is 25%. So basically the debt-to-equity ratio just comes out of the debt ratio. And as I borrow more money, my levered beta goes up, not because I'm in a riskier business, but because I've chosen to borrow money to fund this business. What's a typical debt-to-equity ratio in a leveraged buyout? Does anybody know? 90. It's about 90-10. If you're conservative, it might be 80-20. So if I did a leveraged buyout of Disney, I'm not planning to, so don't spread any rumors. People have been tweeting out during the class, so there are all kinds of tweets. I go back and I read these tweets. I said that? Really? You know? So I didn't say I'm going to do a leveraged buyout of Disney. So this is just a hypothetical. If you did a leveraged buyout of Disney, what's going to happen to its beta? 900%. Its beta is going to be. You're saying Disney with a beta of 7.51? Hey, you can take any company and make its beta any number if you borrow enough money. You say, what does it even mean to have a beta of 7.51? A recession is going to feel like a depression to you. Because think of everything gets magnified 7.5 times. Good times are going to get magnified. Now, do you see why leverage is a double-edged sword? Good times, you're going to make a lot more in returns. Bad times, you're going to lose a lot more. But it also means that because you're taking more risk, you need to make a much higher return. So cost of equity is going to be a function of what your beta is. And your beta is a function of the business you're in and how much you've chosen to borrow. And as you borrow more money, your cost of equity will always go up. Doesn't mean it's a bad thing, because you have another way of now raising money, which is cost of debt, which you have to bring in. But the cost of equity will always go up. Justin? I'm sorry? What did you say? Can you say 7.5? I'm sorry, I don't understand what your question is.
1.11 plus 6.39.
There's rounding all over the place, right? It's in an Excel spreadsheet. You know, it's the second decimal point. You're going to get rounding cut in both directions. Those are not the actual numbers. So when you do 1.1119 times all the numbers and you pull it out of the Excel spreadsheet, so you go to the Excel spreadsheet, you go to four decimals, five decimals, you can very quickly start to get numbers which don't quite match up at the second decimal point. Any questions on leverage? So basically, those are the three things that drive your betas. What kind of business are you in? How much do you have in fixed costs? And how much have you borrowed? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to use those insights to come up with a way of estimating betas for a company which don't require me to depend on a regression. And to do this, I'm going to draw on a property that betas have that make them incredibly easy to work with, which is betas are always weighted averages. You say, what the heck does that even mean? Let's start simple. Let's assume you're a portfolio manager, or you're showing me your investment portfolio and you tell me you have 10 stocks in your portfolio. You say, what's the beta of my portfolio? Here's the answer. I'm going to take a weighted average of the betas of the 10 stocks, weighted by what? How much money you have in each stock. So if you're a mutual fund, I can compute a beta for a mutual fund by taking a weighted average of the betas of the individual stocks. So if this were a portfolio management class, that's where we'd be going. But this is a corporate finance class. I'm going to use this in a different way. When you have a merger, two companies coming together, you know what's going to happen to the beta of the combined company? It's going to be a weighted average of the betas of the two companies that went into the merger. That's it. Weighted by what? By their relative value. So I'm going to take ABC and Disney and show you how that works. What did I say GE wasn't? 26 different businesses, right? If I could give you a beta for each of the 26 businesses, you could come up with a beta for GE by taking a weighted average of the betas of the 26 businesses. You say, how the hell are you going to come up with the betas of the 26 businesses? Leave that to me. If I can come up with betas by businesses, you can come up with the beta for your company. I'm going to use the Disney cap cities first to kind of illustrate the mechanics of betas. In 1996, Disney acquired Cap Cities ABC. Cap Cities ABC, of course, is a broadcasting company. Disney at that time was a theme park movie company. Disney acquired Cap Cities ABC. So I'm not going to ask, are there synergy, cash flows, nothing. I'm going to focus just on the beta effect. So here's what the two companies look like at the time of the merger. It's really an acquisition, Disney buying Cap Cities. Disney had an equity beta of 1.15. Words will have meanings now. So when I say equity beta, I'm talking about a levered or an unlevered beta. It's a levered beta. Equity beta is always levered betas, because the only reason equity beta is different is because I borrowed. The equity beta for Cap Cities is 0.95. At the time of the merger, Disney had $3.186 billion in debt and a market value of equity of $31.1 billion, share price times number of shares. Cap Cities had debt of $615 million, a market value of equity of $18.5 billion. So I've given you the debt and the equity in market value terms. If you add the debt plus equity, the value of Disney as a company in total market value terms is $31.1 billion. The value of Cap Cities as a company was $19.115 billion. If I do a debt to equity ratio, I divide debt by equity, the debt to equity ratio for Disney was 10%, the debt to equity ratio for Cap Cities is 3%. So two standalone companies, I pulled the numbers off from the two companies. So what's going to happen after the merger? You're going to come up with one company, right? The beta is going to be, I said, a weighted average. So here's how I'm going to approach this. And this is actually a generic approach that will work on any merger. So if you follow what I do with Disney Cap Cities, I can give you the most complex merger. InBev, SAB, Miller. And you should be able to do exactly the same thing. So the first step is I'm going to ask, what would the unlevered beta for Disney be after the merger? I'm going to hold off on the levered beta because it depends on how the acquisition is financed. First step is what's your... So here's what I did to answer that. I first computed the unlevered beta for Disney as a company. Remember the equity beta was 1.15, the debt to equity was 10%? The marginal tax rate for both of these companies at the time that I did this was 36%. So So you take the 1.15, you unlever, just like I did the Disney regression beta. With a 10% debt to equity ratio, the unlevered beta for Disney as a company is 1.08. The unlevered beta for Cap Cities is 0.93. So I now have the unlevered betas for the two companies. That's step one. What's going to happen after the merger? You're going to have one company, and the unlevered beta for the combined company is going to be a weighted average of the unlevered betas of the two companies that went in. So 1.08, 0.93, weighted by what? By the values of these two companies as businesses. Not the equity value, but the value as a business. If you go back to the previous page, you'd see that the value of Disney was $34.286 billion. The value of Cap Cities is $19.115 billion. Those become the weights that I use. And obviously, the weights have to add up to 100%. Yeah. Value is both equity and debt. So if I give you a company with $50 million in equity and $25 million in debt, the value of the entire company. So think of it like a balance sheet, right? There's debt and there's equity. The value of the company is the combined value. So that's why you want to focus on the combined values. We're talking about the values of the two businesses. The weighted average that I get is 1.026. The unlevered beta for Disney as a company after this merger is going to be 1.026. Now, to answer what the levered beta is going to be, what do I need to tell you? I need to tell you how Disney is going to finance. This is a big acquisition, right? Money doesn't show up magically. I have to tell you whether they're going to borrow money, issue shares. So let me show you what Disney actually did to fund this merger. If they'd used all equity, and they could have, right? They could have issued shares on the merger. Here's what the beta for Disney's equity would have been after the merger. So let's assume that Disney issued all equity to buy out the $18.5 billion in Cap City shares. But they assumed, you know what I mean by assume? Basically, you take over the company's debt, so it becomes part of your debt. So the debt for Disney after the merger would have been the debt of the two companies put together. But the equity for Disney after the merger would have been their original equity of $31.1 billion plus the $18.5 billion in new equity that they will be issuing because they have to buy back the Cap City shares. So the new equity will be $49.6 billion. The debt-to-equity ratio after the acquisition will be about 7.66%. And their beta after the merger will be 1.08. So that's it. They've done an all-equity-funded deal. That's not what Disney did. Disney actually decided to borrow $10 billion to do the acquisition. Step back again. How much are Cap City shares worth right now? $18.5 billion, right? So if you borrow $10 billion, the remaining $8.5 billion still has to come from equity. So here's what Disney is going to look like after the merger if they do this. The debt will be $31.86 plus $6.15, the two companies' debt, plus an extra $10 billion. Why? That's a new debt that you issued. Your total debt is going to be $13.8 billion. Your equity is going to be $31.1 billion. The extra $8.5 billion is the new equity that you issued. The market value of equity is going to be $39.6 billion. The debt-to-equity ratio is now going to be much higher because you borrowed the $10 billion. It's going to be 34.82%. The beta for Disney after the merger, if they issue the $10 billion, is 1.25. I'm going to leave you with a task, and I'll send you the answer in my email tomorrow. There will be an email tomorrow, so I know that, so I don't have to worry about, will I send an email tomorrow? Here's what I want you to estimate. Could Disney have borrowed the entire $18.5 billion? Sure. What stops them? So here's a question I want to answer. If Disney had borrowed the entire $18.5 billion to fund this acquisition, what would the levered beta for Disney be after the acquisition? Work it out. Say, don't wait for my answer and check it out. Say, that's exactly what I'd have done. Try to do it on your own. Let's see if we get the same answer. First, do you think the beta is going to be higher or lower if I borrow the entire $18.5 billion? Higher. So you got that part right. So now I want to know how much higher. So that's a template. For the merger, always work with unlevered betas first, then bring in the effect of the debt to equity. Yes?
What if you finance a merger with cash?
There's no such thing as cash. Basically, you're just replacing one asset with another, right? So you're saying, what if they had $18.5 billion in cash? All that means is you had $18.5 billion in cash before. Now it's been replaced with $18. But that cash belongs to whom? It's equity. Hey? Ultimately, you are using equity, using internal equity as opposed to external equity. Okay. So we'll talk about how that will show up in the betas, but it's exactly the same process. Any other questions? So now here's the last piece of what I want to do. And this is where I think using bottom-up, I call this bottom-up betas. It's a process by which you replace regression betas. So if you buy into my notion that beta is a weighted average, is the beta for a company then should be a weighted average of the betas of all of the different businesses it's in. What I mean by businesses, you have GE, 26 different businesses, should be a weighted average. Here's the process by which I'm going to try to estimate a bottom-up beta. I'll give you a very simplistic example. Then we'll try this on Disney. So you come to me with a company, say, I'd like the beta for the company. I'm not going to run to a Bloomberg and run a beta regression. I'm going to ask you a question. Tell me what business or businesses your company's in. So this doesn't require any, you know, so basically you're going to be the company, make up a business. Two businesses you've always wanted to be in. No, so footwear, let's make that apparel.
Footwear and automotive.
Automotive. Very strange mix, but it's his company. Okay? So I say, okay, I'll be back tomorrow. So you have an auto business and a footwear business. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to my office. I'm going to collect as many publicly traded footwear companies as I can, and I can find about 100, and as many publicly traded automobile companies as I can. Let's say I find 100. Why publicly traded? Because they're publicly traded. What can I look up for each of these companies? I can look up the betas for each of these companies. I look up the betas for each of these companies. So I have 100 footwear company betas, 100 automotive company betas. I take an average, no game playing, simple average. I come up with an average beta for being in the auto business, an average beta of a footwear company. And then I stop and say, but that's not the beta of being in the business because these companies might have used debt. So I go back and check what the debt to equity ratio is for footwear companies and what the debt to equity ratio is, just like I did for Disney. I do it for each company. And then I unlever both those betas, just like I did for Disney. And what I'm going to end up with is an unlevered beta for being in the footwear business and an unlevered beta for being in the automotive business. Hang in there, because now I'm going to come back to you. So you told me you're in two businesses. How much value do you get from each business? And your first reaction might be, I have no idea what value I get, but I can tell you I get 70% of my revenues from footwear, 30% from automotive. That's all I need. I go back and I take a weighted average, 70% and 30% of those two unlevered betas. I now have an unlevered beta for your company. Then I ask you a final question. How much debt do you have? You might say, I never borrow money, which makes my life incredibly simple, in which case I use the levered beta. Or you can say, I borrow 30% debt, 50% debt, 80% debt. I bring it in, and I come up with a levered beta for your company. Why am I doing all of this? Because I don't like regression betas, right? But what did I use to get the beta for the automotive companies and the footwear companies? I used a regression. In fact, all I've done is replace one regression beta with an average of 100. So what's the big savings? What did you say one of the problems with betas was? There, when I do a single regression beta there, noisy, right? See, I remembered. So what does that mean? You have a big standard. Didn't you say that? Oh, I'm sorry. There's a big standard error. What is it? What happens at standard error when I average out across 100 betas? It goes small. It's the law of large numbers. An average of 100 regression betas is going to be far more precise than a single regression beta. So that's the first saving. The second is, let's say you entered the footwear business yesterday. There's no way a regression beta can reflect it. But I can bring it in because I get to pick what... In fact, you can be proactive and say you're going to be in the computer business tomorrow, and I have no problem. I can bring that into the mix as well. So I can be forward-looking. I'm not stuck with what you did as a company. It's more precise. It's more forward-looking. And I've now opened the door. If you have a private business, because I didn't ask him, are you a public company or a private company? He could have been a private company and told me he was in footwear and automotives, and I could have still done what I did. I can now get the beta for a private business. Yeah. Go ahead. On betas for businesses don't change. The only reason your beta as a company changes is because you change businesses. The automotive business, the beta comes from what? Whether autos are discretionary or non-discretionary. They come from the fixed cost of the automotive business. That's not changing from time to time. The reason backward-looking betas are a problem is not because the beta for your business changes, but because your business mix changes as a company. Right? So if you're HP, your beta for the next 5 years is going to look nothing like the beta for the last 5 years because it's splitting up into two companies. So when you think about backward looking, the problem is not that the historical data gives you the wrong beta. It gives you the beta for a business you might no longer be in. Okay? So the fact that you use backward looking data to get the beta for a business, that's okay as long as you bring in your business mix changing into the beta that you derive for your company. You always have to use backward looking data. This way you're avoiding the issue because you're essentially asking, how is my business mix changing? Yes. We'll talk about that. I mean, let's not make it common. For the moment, let's just keep it at revenues, and revenues are not what I want. I want value. I've used revenues as a proxy, and you're saying that might not be the right proxy. We'll talk about how to adjust revenues, but at least as a starting point, I want to make sure everybody gets what I'm trying to do. So you ready? We're going to try this on Disney. How many businesses is Disney in? First, how do you know what businesses your company is in? You picked a company, right? Kind of have a sense of why you called it a tech company, you might have called it, you know. But where do you go to find out what businesses your company's in? Go to the annual report, go to the 10K. Most US companies will start breaking things down. That's where I went for Disney. And these were the five businesses that Disney said it was in. As I go through each business, see if you find it familiar. The first business they're in is the broadcasting business. What's in there? The ABC that they bought. The little rump that got thrown in with the ABC in 96, which they thought was worth nothing, which is now ESPN. You also have Disney Cable. They also own a piece of this Indian TV, ND something something, and I don't even know the full. But that's all in the broadcasting business. The second business they're in, of course, is parks and resorts. What's in there? Disneyland, Disney World. Euro Disney and Tokyo Disney, they've like management, but it's in there. In 2013, Hong Kong Disney was just kicking in, but today if you did this, there'd be a piece of Hong Kong Disney in there. And when Shanghai Disney opens, of course, it's going to be in there, but that's parks. What's a resort spot? The cruise lines are in there, but also the Dolphin, the Swan, all those hotels around. I call these leech properties. Why? Because nobody in their right mind wants to go stay at the Dolphin unless you're going to Disney World. You're crazy if you put yourself there just, you know, I loaned a nice hotel. Why don't you just hang out outside Disney? Yeah. So they get almost all of their revenues from people coming to Disney. Okay. Studio entertainment. That's Disney's movie business. What's in there? You got Disney animated, of course, but it's kind of expensive. You got Pixar. Keep going. Lucasfilms and Marvel. Marvel actually has been an even bigger hit for Disney than Star Wars ever was. I mean, think of Avengers kind of keeping, you know, the franchise going. So that's all in the movie business. Then you have consumer products. What's in there? Everything they can't find a place for somewhere else. In fact, the person who runs consumer products resigned yesterday. You might have read the story. I think the name is Leslie Ferraro. I wouldn't want to run consumer products for Disney, to be quite honest. You give me everything you don't want. It's primarily a licensing business now. It's one of the largest licensing businesses on the face of the earth. But everybody else sucks up the revenues from the business, right? The theme parks take theirs, so it's whatever's left over. And then you have interactive. You know what that is? All the games, apps. You know, whether you have Disney Infinity, you shouldn't have it on your phone. This is for little kids. But if you do, go back and check it or download it. Disney Infinity, so basically this is their attempt. This is their newest business. Disney's actually very good. They break their revenues down by business, but they also break a bunch of other stuff, which most companies don't. They give you EBITDA, assets, etc. This is my raw material that I'm going to use to try to estimate a beta for Disney. So just like the example that now Disney's given me, what's my next step? I have to get a beta for each of these five businesses. So I know it's getting awfully close to the end, but let me at least start the process. Let's take the studio entertainment business. I'm going to start with the middle, and you're going to see in a minute. So let me take you through the mechanics of how I estimated the beta for the movie business. I went and looked for other publicly traded movie companies. These are all U.S. publicly traded movie companies. I came up with a list of 10. You're saying, why only 10? I'm okay with 10. Are there like 100? Yeah. But beggars can't be choosers. I got 10 movie companies. They're publicly traded, so I have the betas for each of them. I computed the average beta across the movie companies was 1.35. And then I noticed, you know, numbers can be thrown off by outliers. So I also computed a median, and the median beta was 1. So now I have a beta for being a movie company. What's my next step? Is to figure out how much these companies have as debt to equity, and the debt to equity ratio for these companies on average was about 129.33%. And that shocked me. And then I took a look at the companies, and I could see exactly why it was 129.33%. Take a look at all the debt-to-equity ratios. What's causing the debt-to-equity to be so high? You got one basket case, Odyssey Pictures, with a 551% debt-to-equity. It's on the verge of going bankrupt. And it's so I remembered my statistics professor saying, when you have an outlier pulling your average, go back to the median. So the median debt-to-equity is 20. So basically, I'm going to stick with median numbers. Why? Not financial reasons, purely statistical. I'm going to unlever my 1.24 beta using the 27.06% debt to equity. So think of what I did for Disney. I'm going to unlever. The unlevered beta that I came up with for a movie company is 1.03. So I start with the regression beta. I'm taking out the effective debt. And I used to stop that till about 10 years ago until I noticed that companies were doing something that were throwing my betas off. They were accumulating cash. You're saying, who cares? The typical movie company is about 97% movies and 3% cash. The typical cash balance is about 3%. You're saying, so what? What's the beta of cash? Don't think too long. It's zero. So you've got 3% cash with a beta of zero and 97% movies which have whatever beta they want. The beta 1.03 I have is the beta for being a movie company, but I want a beta for just being in the movie business. So here's the last step, is I take the 1.03 and I divide by 0.97, work out the algebra. Basically what I'm doing is I'm taking all of the beta and saying, it's a movie business that's risky, not cash. And the unlevered beta that I end up with for being in the movie business is 1.10. In fact, I'll leave you with this page. When you get a chance, take a look at it because it takes you through the mechanics. I think of businesses in terms of that financial balance sheet that I described. If you take the movie business, here's what it looks like. There's the movie business, 97, cash business, 3. Movie business has a beta, cash business has a beta of 0. Everything is a weighted average. So what I'm doing is I'm starting with the movie business and backing into a beta for being, I'm starting with a movie company and backing into a beta for being in the movie business. When we come back on Monday, I'm going to do the other businesses as well. And then we're on our way to coming up with a beta for Disney as a company.
The reason I was asking about the beta is going from one data that you don't have any statistical data about to looking at more backwards data is because, I mean, isn't in essence still backwards? If you look at, even though it's about a plot equity, like, if you look at the stock, it's more like a pharmaceutical. Because some companies are going to do better than others.
Similar projects. What exactly is a beta for similar projects?
Like if we were investing in an infrastructure firm, this one's going to do highways, and we look at other betas that.
Tell me exactly what you mean by a beta for a highway. Exactly what are you going to do?
For a highway project, that you're going to get returns of 20% opposed to doing like a waterworks.
For your beta, how is that 20% return going to give you a beta? It's a project, right? You don't have returns. So to do a beta, you need historical returns. You need a regression. You can't do that with a project. You need something that's publicly traded so you can get the market price. So there's no way I can get a beta for a highway project, but maybe I can get betas for highway companies. So if I can find companies that build toll roads and highways, and I can get the betas for those companies, I'm essentially saying that is the beta for being in the highway project.
Then if not using beta, you say that using, instead of using CAPM that uses betas, using
tell me any relative risk measure that you can compute without looking at the past.
So it's kind of like this is the best we can do.
In fact, it's not even the best you can do. Past data is always going to drive it. So all you have to do is minimize the dangers of using past data
And one of the dangers of using past data is your company's business mix is changing. Using the past data for the company is not a good enough estimate of the beta. My problem with regression beta is not just they're backward looking, but they're backward looking for the company. Backward looking for the business, I'm okay with, because businesses don't change, but companies do.
Right.
So the real problem with backward looking regression beta is if I run a single regression beta in HP, I'm getting a beta for HP over the last 5 years. And HP has gone from being a computer, printer, business services company to being this separate company. So my problem with the regression beta is not that I use backward data, but I'm assuming that HP's business mix is going to stay what it was for the last 5 years. That's the backward part that gets me into trouble, not using past prices. Because past prices, I have no choice. I always have to use past data. Now, the one area we can take issue is why we're using past prices. Why not use past earnings? Or something more fundamental,
okay.
Prices. That's a different point. The problem you have with earnings is how many observations are you going to get in your regression if you use earnings? Four times a year.
But that would be like instead of using
that's right.
That would be
that's exactly it. It's called an accounting beta. If you have project earnings, you can try using those earnings to come up with the beta. It's very difficult because project earnings actually don't get estimated every quarter. It's a company's earnings that get reported every quarter. So you're still working with highway company earnings, and then you've got to pray that accountants are not smoothing out earnings and doing strange things to make earnings more stable than they truly are.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Professor, I just had a quick question.
Yeah.
So when is the first quiz up to? Is it up to today?
No, through Monday.
Through
session.
Monday as well. Okay. Thank you. And what's so in your practice problems, you list a few subjects, right?
Sorry.
Up to what subject is that?
Risk and return.
Risk and return? Okay, thank you.
So I was doing the risk premium for my company, which is Goodyear. So I split it up revenue-wise like that, like you asked. But some of them, they clump them together, like Europe,
you
Middle East,
you've got to take away the average
so,
of those three.
So